You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Can electric vehicles solve our transport and emissions problems? That's the theme of this week's episode of the Sunday Debate in partnership with Iberdrola. Here's the host, Kamal Ahmed, with more.
Welcome to all of you. It's the second instalment of Energized, this new series from Intelligence Squared in partnership with Iberdrola. Will electric vehicles make our roads green and clean? Now, let's have a few facts about electric vehicles. They are responsible for considerably lower emissions over their lifetime than vehicles powered by fossil fuels. In over a year, just one electric car on the roads can save an average 1.5 million grams of carbon dioxide. Now, with transport being a primary source of carbon emissions, it would seem that electric vehicles present, many would argue, a golden opportunity to make transport environmentally friendly. In the UK, by 2030, cars and vans powered by fossil fuels will be banned. And 5 years after that, so will hybrid vehicles. Car manufacturers such as Ford have promised that by 2030, all of their passenger vehicles sold in Europe will be all electric. But the big question for this evening, are they really the best way to make our roads green and clean? Emissions from electric vehicle production are in fact on average higher than emissions produced during the traditional car manufacturing process. And arguably, they are only as clean as the electricity used to power them. Furthermore, some say the focus on electric cars has neglected other possible solutions, such as hydrogen fuel cells or improving public transports. Are electric vehicles really the best way to solve our transport and emissions problems? Before we go to our leaders, let's see what the results of that initial question are from us. Are they, electric vehicles, the future for a clean and green world? Yes, says 39%. No, say 19%. Undecided, 42%. So, Enrique and Christian, lots to play for. 42% undecided. Let's see which way people's opinions go as the debate continues. So, our first speaker, Enrique Meronio. He is Head of Quality and New Initiatives at Iberdrola, coordinating the sustainable mobility initiatives from a corporate perspective. He holds an industrial engineering degree from the ICAI School of Engineering in Spain and a global energy MBA from the University of Warwick in the UK. Welcome, Enrique. Thanks so much for joining us in this event, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Kamal. Very well pronounced.
Thank you.
There's a well-known quote attributed to Henry Ford after he'd launched the first Model T car. If I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. The same concept can be applied to electric vehicles today. In 1900, there were over 11,000 horse-drawn hansom cabs on the streets of London. There were also several thousand horse-drawn buses, each needing 12 horses per day, making a staggering total of over 50,000 horses transporting people around the city each day. To add to this, there were yet more horse-drawn carts delivering goods around what was then the largest city in the world. This huge number of horses created major problems. The main concern was the large amount of manure left behind on the streets. On average, a horse will produce up to 15 kilograms of manure per day, as well as around 2 pints of urine. So you can imagine the serious scale of the problem. The manure on London streets also attracted huge number of flies, which then spread typhoid and other diseases. The streets of London were beginning to poison its people. But this wasn't just a British crisis. New York had a population of 100,000 horses producing around 1 million kilograms of manure a day. This problem came to a head up when in 1894, the Times predicted in 50 years, every street in London will be buried under 9 feet of manure. This became known as the Great Horse Manure Crisis of 1894. In fact, the terrible situation was debated in 1898 at the world's first international urban planning conference in New York, but no solution could be found. It seems urban civilization was doomed. But then came the invention of the car, not as a solution for the manure crisis, but as an act of innovation, and then the problem literally vanished. The amazing developments of 1900 to 1920 represented, as analysts like Mackenzie claimed, mobility's first inflection point. To lean on Henry Ford once again, looking to the past and desiring faster horses wouldn't have led to this technological innovation and social prosperity. In fact, it would have exacerbated the manure crisis further. From my point of view, the current situation is not that different. We could relate the Great Horse Manure Crisis of 1894 as the late 1800s equivalent of current global warming. It is widely accepted that climate change is the single greatest challenge of our times. And again, an urgent action is needed. And like the manure crisis, the solution does not lie in the past. We must look to the future and embrace innovation if we are to have a fighting chance of slowing climate change. We are already starting to see this happen with technological enablers appearing from other sectors, in this case, computers and smartphones, in the form of enhanced batteries. What's more, we are seeing companies like Tesla or traditional OEMs like Renault-Nissan appearing as innovative entrepreneurs to make electric vehicles a game-changer and enabler of a new mobility second inflection point. To support the previous statement, I would like to highlight three main benefits that EVs provides, electric vehicles provides. First, no tailpipe emissions and no noise pollution. Second, much better energy efficiency, from four to five times better than internal combustion engine. And third, double benefit for the decarbonization of the electricity sector, fostering electric vehicles as a significant lever to achieve the goal of a true zero emission vehicle in 2030 years. Today's motion is about the potential of electric vehicles to make our roads clean and green. Air pollution is a major health hazard for everyone who lives and works in a city. London has introduced its new ultra-low emission zone to try to clean up the air. Anyone who has been to Delhi, Beijing, or Shanghai talks of the air pollution. No tailpipe emissions mean cleaner, healthier air. My final reason for optimism is that we are at the start of the electric vehicle development. If you compare a Model T to a modern Volkswagen Golf, they are barely related. But today's EVs, electric vehicles, the Nissan Leaf or even a Tesla, are the equivalent of the Model T. Just imagine what they will be like in 15 or 20 years' time. I myself have an EV, and it's really fun to drive. The acceleration is incredible, and driving with almost zero noise is a very singular experience. Usually, when I suggest something like buying an EV at home, the first reaction of my wife and especially my mother-in-law is very reluctant. This was also the case, but after several months, they have abruptly changed their minds. It is particularly shocking to see my mother-in-law as she reviews new EV models to buy, especially considering that she doesn't have a driver's license. To summarize, we must not remain stuck in the past. History has taught us that looking to the future and embracing innovation can help us overcome major obstacles, as we did with the 1894 manure crisis. Electric vehicles offer us a mechanism to help solve the climate crisis while also having clear and wide-ranging benefits for human health and the health of our cities. My vote is for the yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Enrique. What a lovely piece of argument, but also storytelling. The manure crisis of the late 19th century is a new one on me, but it was wonderful to also hear about, I think you said your mother-in-law, I think, looking for EV vehicles. Thank you very much for that, Enrique. Incredibly enjoyable. Lovely way to start. Let's go to our second speaker. Now, Christian Wolmar, for anyone who has followed transport for any part of their career or their life, is the granddaddy of expertise. I hope he doesn't mind me using that phrase, but the expert's expert, the person that any journalist worth his or her salt would reach for when wanting an expert opinion, a depth of knowledge in transport, you would always be reaching for Christian's phone number. He's award-winning, but it should be awards-winning in multiple plurals, writer, broadcaster, specializing in transport, and author of a series of books on railway history. He writes regularly for a huge number of publications, from The Guardian to The Times and all over, and is a regular appearer, makes regular appearances on all the main broadcast channels.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Christian, over to you for 6 minutes to put, at least in part, the opposite case.
Thank you, Kamal, and thank you for that introduction. I hope that I can live up to it. I'm going to tell you a story as well, actually, because this electric vehicle revolution has been a long time coming. When I was a kid in the 1960s, growing up in Kensington, up on Camden Hill, which is Upper Hill, the milk used to be delivered by Hoppy the Horse. Literally, Hoppy the Horse, who I gave a sugar lump to every time the milkman came and I saw him, used to pull the cart that had the milk in it. On the other hand, the Harrods deliveries, and this was Kensington, so there were quite a few Harrods deliveries, came by electric van. Managed to get up the hill and quietly delivered the goods. So what does that tell us? That tells us that change is awfully slow. And yet, you know, we are expecting a massive electric vehicle revolution that is supposed to take us up till 2030. You know, most of it is going to happen by then. So, first of all, I don't believe that we can achieve the aims that are set out in various kind of government edicts and the like. Now, look, I'm not going to say that electric vehicles are terrible. They're obviously not. They are somewhat cleaner. They do use less energy once they are manufactured. They're more efficient. But there is a downside. At every advantage you suggest, there is a downside. So, you know, let's suggest that there's going to be lots and lots more electric vehicles and that their prices will go down and that the price of the fuel will go down. What will that do? That will encourage more cars. Do we really want the number of cars that we have in Europe and most of the West to spread out to India, all of Asia and whatever? Do we want that level of car use? Look what's happened in China, where they used to have a wonderful way of getting around with bicycles and it basically functioned as such. And now we have kind of a completely polluted city. So electric vehicles encourage car use. They encourage low density development. So you can commute by car. It spreads out. Low density development is bad for the environment. These houses are energy intensive and they use up a lot of land and they discourage public transport. But cars are kind of enable that sort of long suburban development. Third point is that, you know, electricity is not exactly clean at the moment. If we called these cars coal-powered cars, which is the case in many places, India still produces 70% of its electricity from coal, they wouldn't sound so good, would they? Coal-powered cars or oil-powered cars or whatever. It is, of course, as Enrique has recognized, of course, only the more sustainable forms of electricity that give us an advantage over internal combustion engines. There are all sorts of problems with electric cars. I looked into this recently to possibly try to buy one, but the range wouldn't allow me to get to Wales, where my wife has relatives and the like, without stopping at least once or twice. And, you know, we can't all afford Teslas, right? I know the range of Teslas is much bigger, but, you know, they're still really not the ability to move around kind of across the country. And we don't all live in houses where we can charge up. We live in flats. We live in all sorts of places where it would be very difficult to charge up these vehicles. And you'd have to have wires across the pavement, which people aren't going to like and the like. Then we get into the problem of course, where these batteries are coming from. And look, this is a well-rehearsed argument. We know this. But, you know, the large amounts, maybe 40,000 children working in cobalt mines in the Congo. In its research of this, I found that to produce lithium uses two-thirds of the water in Chile. And, you know, that's to produce a fairly small number of electric vehicles. And 75 tons of acid waste for every ton of rare earth element that is produced. And that is not very sustainable. Finally, of course, there's the other end, which is disposal, the disposal of batteries. And the recent statistics are still that only a very small percentage, maybe 5 or 10% of lithium batteries are recycled. And trying to recycle these batteries is very difficult and dangerous work, which, you know, is bound to be costly, but is also going to be environmentally unsustainable if it's carried out like ship breaking is carried out in kind of third world countries where employment standards are no good. So just to sum up, there is one fundamental problem with these cars, right? They're still cars, right? They still run on four wheels. They still take up a lot of road space. They create congestion. They still need roads which separate out communities within towns and cities with dual carriageways, with motorways and the like. They're still quite dangerous. And indeed, you know, as a cyclist, I sometimes get buzzed by these modern taxis because I don't hear them behind me. So there are those sort of issues. They will still run people over. They'll still encourage car use, which we know is a great inhibitor of physical activity. people will still go for journeys of 1 or 2 kilometres by these cars. It will not encourage public transport. They'll get in the way of public transport. And finally, just look at what happened when there was a transport day at COP26. There was virtually no mention of the most sustainable forms of transport, cycling and walking. All the concentration was on electric vehicles. And that just showed that the priorities are wrong. Yes, electric vehicles, you know, may be a small part of the solution in some instances, but they're not really going to help us be cleaner and greener. Thank you.
Christian, brilliant. A tour de force for the other side of the argument. Audience, your questions are already coming in and they're brilliant. Do keep adding to those. We will come to them shortly. So it's great to see questions already coming in. Do use the Q&A tab function and do tweet as Enrique and Christian's arguments are developed. So Enrique, some strong points there from Christian. Let's go through a couple of them. This notion around the obsession with cars, that whatever type of car it is, the notion that we as individuals should be able to sit in a singular box transporting ourselves around is not actually creating the fundamental discussion we need to have around particularly public transport and, as Christian says, walking and cycling. I chaired an event at that COP26 transport day. And that very much was the debate. So, Enrique, are we simply transferring our obsession for fossil-fueled cars into an obsession with electric vehicles?
It's a very good question. And I tended to agree with Christian and also with you that it's also a problem and it's also an issue, the number of cars. But it's not in the same scale. What I'm trying to say is that there are different kind of problems that are running in parallel. For me, congestions, the number of private cars that you have right now in big cities, it's a local issue. Because, for example, in Spain, 70% of the population lives in 9.6% of the surface. So basically, Spain is a country which is not empty, but a lot of empty spaces. So the problem about cars and about private cars are focused specifically in big cities, like Madrid or Barcelona. Of course, in London as well. But for example, what I'm trying to say is that the complexity to change that, the complexity to change the habits of the people are going to involve a lot of different kind of solutions. There's no one-size-fits-all solution for everything regarding that issue. But on the contrary, the decarbonization of the road transport through the electrification, you are tackling directly health, air quality, and you are tackling also everything related with CO2 emissions, at least a part of that. So for me, there's a different scale. One is a global problem. The other one is local, but probably worldwide spread. But the scale of the problem is different. Usually, we are trying to mix both. We like to mix both. We like to mix electric vehicles and share car sharings, public transport, and there are different issues that we need to tackle in different ways. So for me, the good thing of electric vehicle is that you are decarbonizing, well, at least you are trying to make something viable immediately, because the better efficiency, the best air quality, etc., for the road transport. But of course, you need to tackle also the other issues. But for me, it's another discussion.
Thank you, Enrique. So, Christian, the fact is that, as Enrique says, people are in their cars, commuting in their cars. Car use is where it is. Electric vehicles are better. I'm asking you the question, actually. Are electric vehicles better than a petrol vehicle?
Well,
or a diesel vehicle?
There's two aspects to address here. I mean, one is that because the marginal cost of using your electric car is actually going to be smaller than an internal combustion engine, because the fuel is going to be cheaper. The capital cost is higher, we know that, but the marginal cost is going to be smaller. So therefore, having lots of electric cars will actually encourage people to make just the sort of journeys that we don't want them to make, which is, oh, they could just pop off a couple of kilometres because it's virtually free for them. And if they take the bus, they might have to pay or whatever. So it's virtually free for them to use the car as much as possible. So that in a way exacerbates the problem and is, I think, one of the big arguments why they're not greener. And in the same vein, that the whole idea of this is to make cars more attractive. So you're making them quieter. Maybe you can make them more comfortable because electric cars have a very smooth ride. The acceleration is great. You know, it doesn't make so much noise, all this stuff. So the very nature of electric cars actually goes against the argument that we're going to discourage kind of car use. It actually makes cars better. It makes cars cheaper, and therefore it encourages greater congestion within towns and cities.
But Christian, isn't the point that Enrique is making is that people are in their cars? So unless, Christian, you're saying let's wait until we have the public transport alternatives and let people continue driving fossil fueled cars, it is better to make the transition to EV and have a separate debate around public transport, particularly if you happen to live in a rural area where there isn't going to be a bus and it's too far to cycle and there are no trains.
No, because you're actually encouraging greater car use. That's the point. You're encouraging greater car use because of the attractive nature of it. And the minute you attract more people onto cars, you are, as a corollary, kind of discouraging other forms of transport. So look, the terms of trade are changing here. You know, the electric cars become cheaper and even more attractive. And whereas we should be moving in the other direction, we should be having policies that shift in the other direction. I never buy this argument, oh, we have to provide the public transport first and then kind of see if people go to it. You have nudges all the way through. You push people away from car use into other forms of transport. And the electric cars are doing precisely the opposite. They're nudging them in favour of car use. Of course, some people will have to have cars and some journeys are impossible without. But it's all those marginal journeys that will be encouraged people will be encouraged to make them by electric vehicles.
Christian, thank you so much. Enrique, one brief point before I go to questions. And just to say, I hope people are able to read the chat as well. Some fantastic contributions in the chat. Isabel Sheldon, board member at British Volt. People describing electric car noise. Simon Butcher, thank you for your answer around why are they so noisy. It's actually the tyres. Lydia Ebden talking about the complete change. Do have a look at the chat because it's absolutely brilliant. You two have sparked a debate. But just Enrique, just before I go to the audience questions, the specific questions we've got in front of us, Enrique, what about that argument that EVs are actually decreasing the cost of having individual vehicles and will encourage car use at just the time when we should be discouraging it?
Well, from a point of view, I'm not sure that this is the real debate here, because I think that the problem of acquiring a private vehicle is usually something. If you see the cars today, you can see that the people are not buying cars just because they need it. The people buy cars because they enjoy the user experience. Of course, if you put a lot of good things in a car, it's going to be better, the user experience. But I don't think that the main incentive is that to buy a car, because it's expensive enough to think about it first. I think that, for example, having children at school is an important thing to do if your job is not close to your home and schools are not close enough to your home. There are a lot of different factors that are involved of that, about that. I'm not sure that it's the only incentive to do that. Also, I would like to highlight just one thing. It's not just a matter of public transport versus or against private transport. It's also a matter of infrastructure. Robin Chase, a woman from California, I think, from the U.S., explained that very well. She brought one sentence, which was infrastructure is destiny. So depending, for example, Los Angeles, if you want to encourage people in Los Angeles with 320 miles of perimeter of city to use public transport instead of using private cars, it's going to be very difficult because the infrastructure matters. It's not just a matter of public versus private. It's also a matter of infrastructure. And this is something also very important for the decision of people.
Fantastic, Enrique. Thank you very much. Let's go to the questions, and they are flooding in and also on the chat as well. Brilliant. Simon Kahn or Carney asks, if the most sustainable building is the one that already exists, embedded carbon in brackets, isn't the most carbon efficient electric city car the one that never moves? I think he's getting to the same point, Kristen, that you're making, is he not?
Yes, indeed.
It's a very clever question, Simon. Well done.
Yes. I mean, essentially, there's a point that if you don't use your car much, as I don't, I do possess a car, but I use it very little. Is it really worth my while getting an electric car to replace this car when actually I have a car that you know, I barely use 1,000 miles a year for? So again, when I looked at the idea of an electric car, I realized, you know, actually, I don't think I'd be environmentally more sustainable by getting one.
Now, Enrique, I know you're an honest man. Has having an electric car meant that you drive more because it's just so exciting to be in it with that fast acceleration and you can whiz around and it's really cool? Have you driven more with your electric car or less?
The same, because being honest, I have two daughters. So, I have a very tight agenda. So even though I would love to drive more my electric vehicle, I don't have time to do that. So really, I drive exactly the same amount of kilometers per day.
Great, Enrique. And Kristen, I need to ask you, why on earth do you have a car if you drive 1,000 miles a year? You should get rid of it, surely, in a carbon neutral way.
Just for those journeys that are really difficult to do any other way, some one or two cross London journeys or journeys to outside London when the trains are broken down and or not running or something. Just, I would actually sell it, but my wife kind of says, well, let's just keep it for emergencies.
Okay. Fantastic, Kristen. Now, a question that's been in the chat as well, but is made directly by Siddhant. They ask, is hydrogen power a more viable fuel for vehicles than electricity? And someone asked in the chat as well, I think Clemmy just said, should we not simply wait until they, i.e. hydrogen cars, are ready? Enrique, would that be a better maneuver?
We strongly support in our company green hydrogen. But that being said, we don't think that they are going to be a feasible solution for transport. Why? It's because energy efficiency mainly. Basically, the fuel cell vehicles, fuel cells, you put the hydrogen in, inside the fuel cell, you create electricity, and then you use the electricity to move the car. You are including an extra process, an extra technical process, which decreases abruptly the energy efficiency. So you don't need to do that if batteries are enough. So, and it happens also with heavy duty transport as well. So even though it's currently under discussion, our figures are telling us, and some OEMs, Scania, for example, are saying more or less the same than us, that battery electric trucks are going to be the future in 5 years ahead. So from my point of view, the problem of hydrogen is that using the hydrogen through fuel cells is less efficient. And putting the hydrogen directly in an internal combustion engine, you are losing a lot of energy efficiency because of the internal combustion engine process. So in both cases, I think it's not going to be the future for transport. It's going to be the future for other processes, for example, processes involved in the manufacturing of the car, involves the manufacturing of the chassis, of the outside parts of the car, but not related to the powertrain, basically. That is my point of view.
Can I just say something about that, which is, I think we should explain green hydrogen. Of course, green hydrogen is the hydrogen that will be produced from solar panels and the like, which you can't store the electricity. So you then create hydrogen through electrolysis and store the hydrogen. It's a very complicated process. But one of the real kind of problems writing in this field and covering this field is the constant obsession with the big solution. You know, we're going to solve all the problems with hydrogen, and we're going to solve it with all sorts of different wonderful electric things, or kind of weird vehicles, or autonomous vehicles and shared use and so on, mobility as a system, and all these kind of ideas. And do you know what? Essentially, in towns and cities, we're getting around the same way pretty much as 10 or 20 years after Enrique described the horses. We're dominated by cars. Bicycles actually look completely the same as they did in 1900. We've got buses, we've got underground systems and whatever. It's those systems that dominate and will probably keep on dominating. And this idea that there is this solution that is just around the corner really distracts us from trying to deal with the current problems and the current congestion and all the issues around that.
Thank you, Christian. Enrique, yes, just briefly. Yep, lots of questions to get through, but yes. Yep.
Can I say just one thing? Yes, very briefly. Yes, I would like to highlight just one idea here. It's what I call present continuous syndrome, which is something that we think that if it's happening today, it's going to happen forever. And something that we discover, for example, from solar technology, solar panels, is that the technology nowadays are moving very fast. A range of EVs changed, multiplied for three in the last 10 years, multiplied by three in the last 10 years. This is something just to remind that things are moving on. We are not static. And then I will probably go deeper in that idea. That's all from my side.
Okay, Ricky, thank you very much. Status quo bias, as we say in economics. You're absolutely right. Kristin, I think for you, Jackie Pedersen in the chat has given a very good suggestion. The answer to small use of your car is to belong to a car club. So, Kristin, do investigate that with your wife. Now, this is an anonymous attendee. Will batteries in electric cars ever be good enough to make using them as convenient as cars that run on fossil fuels, both in terms of battery life and how long they take to charge? Now, Christian, that's not the big question as you suggest we should be answering, but Enrique, as a man with his finger on the pulse of the technology, how do you answer that?
Yes, I think that the most important thing here is that to understand that the energy density of the battery, which is the amount of energy that you can have in 1 kilogram of battery, has almost doubled in the first 10 years. And we are expecting to double with the same technology in the next 10 years. That implies that if today, for example, I have a Hyundai Kona, it's not a Tesla, it's not a fancy car, but it's really good, really affordable, and with more than 400 kilometers of range, real range. So now range is not the big deal for electric vehicles. It's something that is sorted out. The problem right now, from my point of view, is price. So focusing on batteries, what I'm trying to say is that batteries right now, and we have information for the first Nissan Leaf of 2010, 2011, is lasting more or less 10 years, with at least 80% of the battery intact, at least 80%. This is real information and real data. That means that for the future, we more or less expect at least 10 years of life. But probably with the new batteries, solid-state batteries, or new chemistry, we are going to have even more than, for example, a internal combustion engine. What I'm trying to say here is that the data that we have today, it's giving us a very optimistic point of view about the durability and the capacity to charge in higher power. And just to end about that, today Porsche Taycan can charge at 280 kilowatts, which means probably less than 30 minutes of charging 80% of the battery. This implies that probably most of cars in the next 5-8 years are going to charge less than 30 minutes, at least 80% of the battery, even 15 minutes in some cases. Probably in the premium segment would be 15 minutes. Less than that, no. But 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes is something much more affordable than 2 hours or something like that. So we are working in higher power, and this is something that you are going to see in most models today and increasingly in the following years.
Thank you, Enrique. Really helpful. Christine, if I could come to you with the next question. So if cars are too big and we don't want more on the road, how about promoting smaller vehicles like electric scooters, electric bikes? Is this a viable alternative?
Well, it's not a viable alternative for everyone, but certainly one has seen already that scooters, I think I'm quite supportive of scooters. I think they might be something of a game changer. I think they're rather dangerous at the moment. They're uncontrolled, they're unlicensed, people ride them on pavements and whatever. But they may well take some cars off the road. But essentially, we need a transport policy. And you know, I've written a book about transport policy that basically said there has never been a transport policy. But we actually, you know, at this stage in time, after COP26 and whatever, we actually need a transport policy that looks at reducing the amount of transport we need. And that's what we've never had. So all these things are partial solutions, and they're working towards, you know, a better kind of environment and the like. But until we actually tackle the problem of saying we don't need more mobility, we don't need to get around more, we need accessibility. And that's a very different concept. So we need the local facilities to be near. We need the local schools to be near. We need the hospitals to be near. We need to live in kind of quite dense environments and so on. And then that will create the preconditions by which we need fewer cars. And that's happening to some extent. You only have to look at London, see where are the developments. The developments are in places with kind of railway stations and quick access, you know, Crossrail, for example, is stimulating vast number of developments. So it's a much longer term issue than just saying, oh, well, we need to few more people to be using kind of scooters and bicycles or whatever. It's a fundamental planning issue, which we should be treating as part of the climate emergency.
Thanks. Thank you, Christian. Enrique, back to you. It's really to address a point made by Christian in his opening remarks, but also made by members of the audience in the chat as well. The awful statistics, as it's described here by the questioner, about manufacturing the batteries, child labour, huge water consumption, lithium making consequences, and then disposing of them, huge pollution ? A crucial point, the questioner says. How do you answer it?
Well, there is a lot of background noise relating this issue, because you need to understand that we are here debating this basically because there are some points that are not clear. And some points are, you know, the storytelling are, you know, created by the OEMs, and some OEMs are not very happy to change their production lines and all the business and our 50, 80 years of internal combustion R&D and, you know, push forward like Tesla or other traditional OEMs that are more bold in this new transformation. To do that, what I'm trying to say is that there's a lot of data regarding the emissions of in the manufacturing of the battery that are not strictly accurate. Sometimes they are using data from 2015, 2016. Sometimes they are using data that is they are temporary. For example, let me explain just one thing. We know that probably more of the battery factories are going to be close to the car factory because it's going to be cheaper, it's going to be easier. China today manufactures 20% of the whole car fleet worldwide, but it's manufacturing a big percentage of batteries, and 80%, 60, more than 65% worldwide. So people are saying, well, most of the batteries are manufacturing in China with a lot of coal, so it's bad for the climate. And I understand that. But it's a temporary situation because it's going to change. Europe is going to build more battery factories. US is going to build more battery factories. So probably in the future, you are going to see more or less the same percentage than today. 20%, 27% of batteries manufactured in China, but not today, probably in the future. But this is going to happen probably. The other thing is the disposal. Regarding that, I would like to remind that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the lead acid batteries, the percentage of disposal was really small. And today, the percentage is more than 98%. So we need to build a business, you know, related to this kind of disposals, because there's a lot of useful materials that we can reuse. And this is something that is going to happen. Of course, it's going to happen. That is what I'm telling you about the status quo bias that you said, or the present continuous syndrome. It's something that it seems that it's going to be exactly the same, and it's not true. It's not going to be exactly the same. It's going to change. It's changing. How many percentage of Chinese cars are selling in Europe or in the US or outside China? Very small. So, you know, it's a false debate to focus on that. And also, and this is just to end, our numbers shows us that only 10% of all the emissions related to manufacturing belong to batteries. Only 10%. This is our numbers. So, you know, it's the problem here is the background noise, the fight with one data and the other data, and it's difficult because we need to check the assumptions, and always we don't always have that opportunity to check the assumptions. But honestly, I think that you know, this is something that is going to change, and in the right way, absolutely.
Can I just challenge something there, because you didn't really address the issue of the mining of cobalt, lithium, other rare earths and stuff. You just say, oh, well, the statistics, and that you might be right, that the statistics might be improving. But nevertheless, do you as an industry, have you done enough to try to ensure that these are mined sustainably and to actually work out whether it is actually possible to mine these sustainably at all, or whether, you know, whether this is just going to always be a fundamental problem?
The only thing that I know for sure is that the OEMs are changing continuously the chemistry of the batteries, the chemistry. Cobalt is decreasing continuously, and it's going to decrease more. We know perfectly what is happening in Congo and other places related to cobalt, and we are pushing a lot to decrease that amount, and I'm sure that we are going to see, a mix of chemistries with less impact in the future. Chemistry are changing continuously. You don't know, but not you, Christian. Of course, I am telling for the thinking about the audience. But if we talk about lithium ion batteries, it's not just one single battery. There's a lot of different chemistries that are changing continuously. And this is something that we need to be aware, that we need to focus on that, because I agree with you, there are certain problems that we need to address properly. But the best way to address that is to decreasing this kind of components, and the companies are doing that. But we are in a process. This is not something that is ended. It's in a process of improvement. That's my point.
Okay. There. Enrique, thank you so much. Thank you, Christian, for that question. I'm just very aware of the time. Thank you so much for your questions. Sorry that we have to move the debate on. The chat is amazing. I hope Intelligence Squared can capture some of the arguments there and the membership can get hold of those, because it really is brilliant. The expertise we've seen on the chat is fantastic, and a little bit of wit in there as well, which is always nice to see. We're going to move on now to the final part of the debate. So it's going to be 2 minutes of closing arguments from Enrique and Christian. And then we'll have our final vote and see who has changed their minds through this debate. But Christian, for 2 minutes, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, let me first of all debunk one myth, which is the idea that somewhere like Los Angeles is so spread out you can never do anything else but be dependent on cars. Actually, oddly enough, Zurich, which is one of the most sustainable cities in the world, has almost the same intensity of population as Los Angeles. So it's a matter of policies. We can actually change this. And I think that we have to keep that in mind. We are not necessarily in hock to the car. The car, you know, might well be seen as a transient, crazy invention which has caused more damage, more ill health, more pollution than any other, and therefore just making the car slightly nicer, slightly better, I think is the wrong solution. We have to look and concentrate our resources. There's an opportunity cost here, which I think is essential, that if you just concentrate and say, well, EVs are going to be the solution. I mean, I've written a book on driverless cars, which for a while was kind of being portrayed as the ultimate solution, and they're going to be shared use electric autonomous cars. In fact, I've debunked that completely. Somebody on the chat has actually mentioned that, but there is no kind of way that we are going to have a world full of shared use electric driverless cars. That there's no way that anybody wants that, or that it's kind of achievable. And I think Enrique has to deal with the problem of saying, deal with the problem of the current production of EVs. And it's no good just saying, well, we're going to find solutions in the future. We've heard that kind of thing before. You know, the whole production of EVs at the moment is reliant on a very, very dirty industry. And therefore, we can't kind of then say, oh, well, you know, it's going to get better in the near future. It's going to improve. We have to realize that this is not part of the solution. It's just adding to the problems that have already been caused by our dependence on cars.
Thank you very much, Christian. Enrique, the final 2 minutes to you.
Thank you very much. I want to highlight just one thing, because I would like to stress just one point here. I think that this debate is not, you know, cars against no cars, or this debate is about electric vehicle. So we need to focus in if the electric vehicle can make our roads cleaner and healthier and greener. And from my point of view, this is something that it's true and it's happening. The other issue that I completely agree with Christian, which is the problem of the big amount of private cars on the streets, is a very complex issue in which we don't have a clear solution for that. But regarding the decarbonization of the road transport, we have a very good solution that can decrease abruptly the amount of emissions of transport. And this is something that is going to develop in the future. What I'm trying to, you know, raise here, and what I'm trying to encourage you, is that the batteries has an impressive, you know, performance improvement in the last 5-10 years, and they are going to have it. And the industry are going to work very closely in order to decrease these things that they are not working properly. If everything it's okay and EVs are excellent, we didn't have this debate. It's impossible to have a debate of something that is clear. Of course, it is not clear. But what I'm trying to try to highlight is the importance to focus in what we can solve, not what we don't know how to solve. This is my final point. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Enrique. So back to you, our audience, and look how many of you have been with us in this amazing debate. Thank you so much, Enrique. Thank you so much, Christian, for all the thoughts. And thank you so much, audience, for the brilliant chat, brilliant questions. So let's ask the question for the final time. Please do vote now. Yes, electric vehicles will make our roads green and clean. Or no, electric vehicles will not make our roads green and clean, via the poll on your screen. And if you are still not sure, then vote undecided. And we'll get the results of that in a second. Christian, can I come to you while we're just waiting for that? It takes a minute or so to come through. Christian, what is the solution if it's not electric vehicles? Do we stick with fossil fuel powered cars for longer, given that it is people feel it is a right to be able to drive and it's enormously convenient for many people? Or do we have an abrupt stop of the right to drive?
No, I think we can't quite do that. What I would suggest is that we need an overall strategy, with possibly with targets, and then we need a whole series of nudges and pushes. And we've been going in exactly the wrong direction, Kamal, as you know, as an economist. We've had fuel tax rises cancelled for the last 11 years. They're always put forward and they say, no, we're going to cancel it as a bit of good news in the quote unquote in the budget. And then we've had rail fares go up by the rate of inflation, or at times 1% above the rate of inflation. We've had vast amounts of government money put into all these crazy, crazy kind of schemes like autonomous vehicles and bizarre technologies that they think will be a solution. And we haven't just invested in the fundamental things like buses, improving bus services, improving cycling infrastructure, improving pavements to make it easier to walk, making access to schools much easier, all that kind of stuff. So it's a whole kind of gamut of things that you need to do, and we shouldn't be distracted by technology, because actually, as I suggested, much of the way we move is pretty much like we used to move 100 years ago, apart from kind of high-speed trains and 747s.
Thank you so much, Christian. Enrique, final sentence, are you still feeling optimistic?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm glad to hear it. The votes are back. Let's see how this debate changed people's minds. Let's not forget that at the beginning, yes to the question greener and cleaner, 39%. No to the question greener and cleaner, 19%. Undecided, 42%. The final vote, yes, greener and cleaner, 49%. No, 35%. Undecided, 42%. Which gives me great delight in saying, Enrique and Christian, you have both upped your percentage of support with your passionate thoughts and arguments in this amazing hour we spent together. But in the end, the audience does believe, a bigger percentage of the audience does believe that it will mean greener and cleaner roads. Just for me to finally say thank you so much to Enrique and to Christian for that fabulous event. Do go on to the Intelligence Squared website, where there will be a recording of this event very shortly. And also do join us for our next event, which is also on the website. I wanted to say thank you so much to Intelligence Squared. Thank you so much to Iberdrola for staging this event and also for supporting the whole Energize series. How important is it? Well, we've just seen the passion in this event. Do go over onto Twitter or other social media platforms to continue this discussion. Thank you so much for all the comments we've had. They've been absolutely brilliant. Thanks again for joining us, and have a very pleasant evening. Good night.